I think they ended up with the eighth day. The maids are turning better.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's so great.
Are they going to have the little train in?
I don't know.
I think they've retired. They're selling their business, so they won't be there.
Who's that?
The little train.
How many applicants are actually in it now? Because last I heard there was only four.
Oh, no, there's more than that, isn't there, Joanna?
I think there has been.
Is there now?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, yes. Sure, I forwarded it to a handful of people, but whether they chose to go forward with it, I don't know, because they were like, oh.
Yeah.
No, Patrick bought my little train from me.
It would be.
They're not.
Oh, maybe they're two separate.
Oh, I think
trains.
They might be in it. I don't know that they filled out an application.
Oliver Hammer had it for years and mm-hmm. years. I had it for about 4 years and fixed it up.
So it's 6:01, and why don't we go ahead and start the council study session. Since we're here, why don't we stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And for the record, I'll take roll. Councilman McGoffin?
Present.
Councilwoman Diamond?
Present.
Councilman Allen?
Present.
Councilwoman Kesty?
Present.
Councilman Lavaca?
Present.
Councilman DeYoung?
Present.
And Councilman Owen asked to be excused tonight, so he's got a personal issue that he's dealing with.
Madam Mayor? I'd like to move the excuse of Councilmember Owen, please.
Second.
All right. So we had a motion by DeYoung, seconded by McGoffin. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. Motion carries. And Bill did, I already said it, I don't know if everybody was here, but because of our masks, it's hard. We only have one mic, and so it's hard to pick up everything. So try to speak loud and clear when speaking tonight. If you will, please. Okay. All right, so we'll move right into the new business, and that is beginning with the 2021-2022 mid-biennial budget. So,
good. Thank you. As you may or may not know, since you have adopted a two-year budget, a 2021 and 22, it's required by state law that we have this meeting between August and December to go over how we're doing in 2021 and have any discussions or questions the council will have. What this will lead to is a budget amendment that you will see before you on December 8th. So we'll kind of go over where we're at, and then you'll see a budget amendment to true up some of our numbers that we currently have in our packet this evening. So I'll start off. We always are most focused on the general fund and our utilities. We call those our operation funds, and what that means is that there's employees within those funds. So we have 42 funds in the city, but the ones that have employees in them are the ones that we're really going to focus on this evening. And the most critical fund that's one we keep our pulse on at all times is our general fund, because that's the one that tends to have challenges when it comes to revenues or expenses. So we're going to go ahead and just jump right in. The good thing is, as you can see, overall, our total general fund revenues are up this year. I do want to make a caveat that a portion of that is due to a grant, the ARPA, money that we received for COVID. We received about $1.7 million this year on that. So a portion of that is due to ARPA. And then as you've seen when you went through the graphs, I'm sure, is that there's an increase in our permitting revenues this year because of the active activity that we have going on in permitting. So, but it's always a good thing when you see that your revenues are exceeding your budget. So that is a good thing. I will be making a proposal early in 2022 when we start talking about 2022 to actually take the ARPA monies out of our general fund and putting them into their own separate fund. Because we will be discussing, what are we going to do with those funds? How are we going to invest those funds? So I just want to let you know you'll see that, but not till 2022. We'll just start going through. So I'm on page 4. Again, there's the total revenues. And please know we're just looking at September, so the graph is a little bit off because I erred in adding in the last quarter data, and so But you can see we're under a little bit in our general fund. In our monthly, we run up or down in any given month. But overall, we're doing very well with our revenues. Also with our expenses, we are running a bit below our budget in expenses. So that's a good thing. As you know, staff here is pretty efficient and effective with their funds, and they're very protective of the and good stewards of the public's money. So that's just those first two on page 4. So we'll roll right through to page 5. I think I've already spoken enough about the total revenues. Let's go ahead and roll forward to page 6. The first graph there is the property tax revenue, and so that's pretty predictable. We know how much we're going to be collecting, and as long as our residents are able to pay their property taxes, we collect what we're budgeting for. So as expected, that is right on budget. Our sales tax revenue is over what we had predicted, so that's a very good sign. So it's a trend that's hard to predict, and it's something that, it's hard to rely on, because at any given moment, consumers can stop making those purchases. But we've been very blessed over the last few years. Consumers just continue to keep on spending, even though we thought that there might be a downturn in those revenues. So, and we did predict our sales tax revenues would go down when we were doing our budget in 2020, looking forward to 21 and 22. Yes, 21 and 22. So, next page 7. These are business and utility tax, and as Councilmember Allen alluded to, things should be at about 75% now, and that is exactly where we are with our business and utility taxes, 75%. Business licenses have picked up just a tad, but right on target. Going on to page 8, our permit revenue is where we are seeing a considerable increase from what we had budgeted in late 2020, so that's definitely on the rise, and probably will continue at least through 2022, but then we'll start seeing a slowdown. But remember, those revenues are really one-time revenues, so we don't ever, use those to fund ongoing costs. So they are special projects that the council might have, or special investments, one-time investments that we need to make, stuff like that. That's what we use permit revenues for. The next line item is graph is intergovernmental, and it looks like we're way exceeding budget there, but that is where those ARPA funds, about $1.684 million, is sitting. So if you remove that, then we're right about on target on those intergovernmental funds. And moving on to page 9, another fund that looks like we might be way over our revenue budget, but this is due to the school impact fees that we've been collecting with the development. So even though you're seeing this here as being in excess of budget today, after December 8th when we do our budget amendment, this will be one of the items that will amend the budget to make it more, to match more realistically to what is really happening. But those funds are just pass-through monies, and you will see when we get to the expense side, we've got the same situation going on. We're over budget in our expenses, and it's just exactly the same thing, monies that are going to be going out, and we'll be doing a budget adjustment there. And then our other revenues, those are very hard to predict, so we're a little bit behind, but those are very cyclical and hard to predict, but we're a little bit behind on what we were hoped to get in those, but not a significant impact. All right, any questions on revenues?
Just institutionally, just kind of grins and smiles. We've lost North Cascade Board or whoever they were, and we've lost Mike and son. What kind of whammo did that? Do you know institutionally what we lost on a couple of car lots?
Yeah, I don't know the exact figures, but you can imagine that they are significant. Yes. Significant.
Actually, when we lost the Ford one, that was, so Aaron Berg was still here, so that was 18 or 19.
Right. No, I'm not blaming Debbie.
Oh, no,
and
no.
then Mike and Sons, they
no.
sold a lot of cars.
Yes.
And that's
yeah,
a
so,
lot of sales tax, you know.
Well, actually, we didn't lose all that much. We thought it was going to be significant, but when Doug ran the numbers, it really wasn't. So they were not selling a whole lot of cars here. But the Ford dealership did have another, and they still do, a dealership in Burlington, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they did a better business over there, I don't know. But I can't answer for Mike and Sons, but I can tell you the Ford dealership here, which is why they left, because it just wasn't, there just wasn't money to be made here.
But it still amounts to quite a bit when you're getting 10% on a $40,000, $60,000.
And do remember, the city doesn't receive 10%.
No.
We receive a little tiny 0.67%.
Yeah,
so
no percent.
Yeah, so we do not receive the, we just like property tax, there's a big number, but we don't, the city doesn't receive that much. We just receive a little portion of it. So.
But it didn't impact our budget at all.
Okay.
So that's how little it was.
So it kind of explains a business decision.
Yeah.
Good question, though.
Kevin, I had a question. On some of the revenue graphs, it was showing us ahead of the estimated value. Is that going to help offset some of the additional costs that we're going to experience with, like, the payroll increase?
Potentially, but again, the ones that are really off the graph are due to one-time money. So, yes, in 2022, what will happen is we'll have a better beginning fund balance, so our bank account will be better than we thought it was going to be when we did our budget. So, yes, it will help in 2022, but we got to think long-term, and potentially that might not be the right, you know, solution. But interimly and temporarily, yes, it will offset those costs that we're going to see coming up.
Okay.
Yeah. But when we start, early next year, we'll be starting our 23-24 budget conversation, and we'll be thinking longer term. We'll probably even be doing, you know, 4 to 6 year projections to try and get a good feel to make sure that we're being, you know, good with our estimates and our plans and our dreams that we want to implement. So
there was, you mentioned that business licenses and permits and that sorts of things. Was that what kind of businesses are coming in? Or what, just so we have kind of an idea of what could be coming through in the industry.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I know we're going to start focusing on economic development, and those are going to be things that we're going to definitely start watching and trending and things like that, and you'll see that is an investment that we want to start making with maybe our ARPA monies to assist our business community to start getting a better understanding what businesses are here, what's lacking, you know, call it leakage, you know, what's not here, so, and what do our citizens want, so... right now, I don't have a good response for you.
Okay.
I know one of the reasons our licensing is up is because when we went to the state of Washington to do business licenses, that requires businesses to get a city license if they're registering. In the past, it was, you know, obviously mandatory, but they had to actually come in and get their business license and do that. So right now, it is automatic. So that does help. And we kind of allowed it during COVID to slip a little bit, you know, wanted to give some grace to our businesses that were really struggling. And so just recently we did do an effort to do some collections and get people caught up on their business license. So that's maybe a little bit of the uptick. But there are some new businesses. And with all of the development activity that's going on, we require anybody that's doing anything in the city to have a business license. And so we're seeing that as well. And that's also helping with our sales tax revenues right now as well, because anytime there's building and development going on, the city does receive a portion of that sales tax revenue. So that all, it all kind of plays out. It's the joy of economic development.
To coattail on your question, business life, is that just retail, or does that go on to corporations and larger businesses and trucking companies, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, anybody who has a Cedar Woolley address for their business, but also anybody who's coming into Cedar Woolley to do business, we require them to have a business license too. So contractors and corporations. Oh yeah, all our banks, they all have to have business licenses. So everybody.
Trina's also been really good about catching some of them too, where people have in-home businesses and are not aware that they need a business license. They think that if it's in their home, they don't need to do that. But she's been able to catch some of those. So.
Yeah, she's done a great job of getting that going, so appreciate her work.
Has Amazon helped us quite a bit?
Yes, Amazon has helped us in our sales tax revenues. It's one of our leaders in, you know, from year to year to year when you look at the growth from different perspectives, and Amazon is one of our leading, it is our leading sales tax.
When they changed collecting sales tax based on delivery location rather than the shipping location, it made a huge difference for local cities.
Yes, and especially with COVID, everybody was getting their packages at home and not getting their packages where they worked if they potentially didn't work in the city. So
right.
That helped us too. So, but yes, I think obviously purchasing, everybody's consumer purchasing has changed dramatically, good and bad. I mean, you still like that experience, you know, that you need when you go there and work with our local businesses. So, but we'll get them online and get them up and running too to make sure that they can be competitive. So, good. All right. So, moving forward then to expenditures. As I said, we're under budget in our expenditures. That's pretty typical for cities and for us. I've noticed in the past it's exactly what typically happens. So I can kind of go through the different. I'm on page 11 now, Bill. So legislative, that's obviously the work that we do here. Court services are a little bit under budget. We did have a brief amount of time where we didn't have it fully staffed, so that would have caused that some savings there. Our executive branch is a little bit under budget. There are some projects, professional service projects that we thought we would get done in 2021 that are probably going to push to 2022. A salary, as we read the last council meeting, we need to do some salary work and stuff like that. So those will get pushed to 2022. The finance department, a little bit under budget. Which is good, too, because as when you have retirements, you have payouts of accrued balances and things like that. So it's really nice to see that that hasn't caused us any strain on our budget. Legal's under budget. IT is under budget. Centralized services, just things that are shared amongst everyone in the city. That's what centralized services, they're under budget. Planning and development. Engineering, law enforcement's right on budget. Fire control is a little bit under budget. And then the next graph on page 16, sorry, Bill, I was going pretty fast. On page 16, the general government, health, and transfers, this is the one that looks like we're overspending our budget. That's where those school impact fees land. So I will be doing a budget adjustment to that, and so that won't look like that in the future. And then protective inspections. This is a graphing challenge. I included the last three quarters. I should not have done that. Have I not done that, they're fine. They're under budget. So it's just because it was pulling from the bottom number instead of the September number. So that's the general fund. Anybody have any questions on expenses of the general fund? I can help you. Pretty straightforward. Good. So the next graph, page 18, Bill, we're going to move on to what we call our enterprise funds, and these are funds where we collect revenues, so our utilities. We have three: sewer, solid waste, and storm. So as you can see, all of those, sewer is definitely exceeding, they're right on with their revenues and expenses, which is nice to see. We will have some repairs and maintenance that we weren't anticipating, but we should get some proceeds either from FEMA or our insurance company to help offset some of those costs. They probably won't roll into our financial statement till January. It takes that much time for everything, but we feel like we'll have some coverage there. We probably will have a little bit of out-of-pocket monies to fix that. Solid waste is right on budget. Storm is a little bit over budget, so I'm on to page 19, Bill. We did an analysis of this because we were wondering why, because it's pretty, Nathan manages this fund and he's very good about managing it. Well, we did a change in our budget in 2020 where we moved some of the vehicle fuel for our street sweeper over into our storm fund. We did that when we were actually coding our bills, but we forgot to do that when we were setting our budget. So you will see a budget adjustment making up for that. So that's that's one of the reasons here in storm. And then repairs and maintenance. I think you do have heard our equipment has been breaking down on us a little bit more than usual, and so those repairs and maintenance costs have skyrocketed for everyone. So you will see that as a budget adjustment as well. Equipment repair and replacement fund. This is where we reserve monies every month for all the various departments for not only equipment replacement, so thinking into the future, what kind of equipment we need to buy, but also maintenance and operation of that equipment. So, because that's kind of sometimes forgotten, that you have to take care of the equipment that we currently have. So the city's done a great job of setting up, we can probably thank Doug for this, where you're actually setting aside money for maintenance and operations. And kudos to you. That's great. The next one are our special revenue funds. I'm on page 20. These funds have a dedicated revenue source, usually from the state through different taxes and different things like that, or we've designated them as special revenue funds, and we fund them through our general fund. So that's kind of what these ones are. That's your Parks and Facilities Fund. They're running a little bit high in expenditures, again, with repairs and maintenance, and some of the projects that we did this year. We didn't quite have the budget that we should have had in there, so you'll see a budget adjustment for some of those projects. And some of them were just that we thought we were going to finish them in 2020. They really didn't get finished until 2021, so we just need to make sure and move the monies into 2021 because the money's sitting in cash and the beginning fund balance, and it really should just go to the project. So, cemetery fund is right on target. Street fund and arterials, those two, act together. So obviously arterials are more of our main route and main roads, and then street funds just all over the different projects that get done. The street sweep, not street sweeping so much as that storm, but just all kinds of different things that the street department does for our community. So. And that concludes my overview of the general fund and the special revenue funds and the enterprise funds. So these funds are all funds that have staffing. So I call them operations, overall our operations.
When can you see the amendments? When's that going to happen?
Yeah, so that will be in your packet December 8th, so
okay.
Friday or this weekend, you'll see that. You'll see the actual detail behind all the amendments. So, yeah.
Thank you.
You bet. On the next page 22, this just shows you the cash or the balances that we have. So it's called the ending fund balance. So the money that we have as a city, how do we take care of that? How do we invest it and make sure that it's earning money and not being idle? So we've got almost $15 million in our investment with the state of Washington. It's called the LGIP, Local Government Investment Pool, where all the local governments pool their money and then it gets invested. Very short term. And because of the rate structure that we're currently under, we hardly are getting any interest on that. So, but we also do have about $1 million as of September 30th in investments because we're trying to get a little bit more interest. But I recently just invested another $2 million. So I took $2 million out of the LGIP and invested it in some bonds. So that'll have a little bit better, way better return than the LGIP. Again, it ties our money up a little bit longer because those are typically 3 to 5 year investments if they don't get called. You have to kind of always do an analysis to see like what projects, how far out of our projects, and match our cash flow to our investments. You don't want to get too invested because then you don't have any cash flow for things that we have to do. And then the rest of our funds where they sit, just in U.S. We have all our banking is with U.S. Bank. Some petty cash, and then the county always has a little bit of money of ours from property taxes. So that's the cash picture right now.
I know we were approached by Banner Bank. So what was the decision there?
I probably will be doing a RFP for banking services. Bank costs are going up, and I've noticed a considerable bump up at U.S. Bank. I do have a meeting with them next week, actually, to have a discussion. But I am probably going to be doing an RFP for banking services and see if we can get those costs down. It's about a $15,000 to $16,000 a year cost right now, and that's better invested in our community than in a bank. Good question. And then the last page is just to show you in just a snapshot page 23 is just a snapshot of where we are, total revenues to total expenses, how we are on budget. So, but the overall, we're doing good, and that, you know, we'll keep up the good work until we hear from other things.
Is that your prognosis, Doc?
That's my prognosis. We're doing pretty good.
Okay.
So I will begin now looking at 2022 in a little bit, you know, finer comb and pencil and making sure that things, you know, are appropriately budgeted. And we'll start early on, probably January or February, having conversations about 2022. We know there are some significant impacts that we had not anticipated in the budget already. And so we need to, you know, kind of get those incorporated into the numbers and see where we really are, and then go from there. I know our team, our leadership team, we're already looking at what we may be able to stop spending. So that is something that we're all very conscious of in the city. So
with all the flooding, do we have any FEMA monies coming in, or will there be any more COVID monies coming in, or are they all dried up, or the FEMA dribbles in, or how does that work?
Yeah, no, we'll definitely be putting in a FEMA claim. We're actually gathering all of our costs and, you know, and the impact of the things that our report is due to FEMA on December 8th, I just saw. So quickly here, I want to say Julie in Public Works is doing an amazing job of gathering everything and keeping track of everything. So there will be, I believe, it sounds like it, there will be FEMA money available to us. And again, as I showed, our insurance as well. So, yeah. And that's my report, my mid-biennial report. Again, you will see on next week's packet ordinance to amend the budget. It will be an action item because that will be potentially, and if you agree, our last council meeting of the year. So you'll see it next council meeting.
Abby, do you want to talk about positions at all? 22. You want to put those out there tonight? Or?
Would you want to start talking about those? This is some other things that, as I share, there's some things that we're hoping to implement in 2022. So. And these are some of them, so, and I'll help you.
Yeah, there are three of them that we're talking about, potentially funding, and we've talked a little bit previously about at least one of these. Actually, I'm sure you've probably heard about a number of them. So Mark Freiberger is actually out there on Zoom, and he's going to talk about a couple of positions in Public Works. I just wanted to talk briefly about an HR position, an HR manager position. So historically, the city administrators here have handled HR for the city, and there's generally been some support from finance, but we haven't had an HR professional on staff in the city as long as, at least back several administrators. Maybe there was one many years ago, I don't know, but typically people have worn many hats. As cities grow, those hats start to get separated and come off, and things get more specialized, and that positions the city better as it continues to grow, to kind of build around those functions. And we feel like we're getting very close, likely across the line, where we're investing in an HR position would be a really worthy thing for us. We tend to be reactive, not proactive, much of the time in HR, and that is a challenge for the city, and it creates liability as well. One of the examples of that is a personal policy manual. We have one from 1990, but those are things that you want to update every few years, and we're in the process of doing the math giant update that we need to do on that, and that will be coming before council at some point. But that is basically a document that helps govern our policies, practices, and procedures internally with how we deal with HR issues. So it's a pretty critical document that we're working hard on. In terms of HR, the function and the reason why you bring these positions on is really to look at balancing the needs of the employees versus the needs of the organization. So your HR your HR manager is the person who's really going to be the advocate for your employees, making sure that voice is heard. They support having a diverse workforce that's safe and discrimination and harassment free, that the environment is that way. They help maintain compliance with employment laws, with government regulations. They provide management and employee training, and they develop policies and procedures. They also do a fair amount of training and development in areas like effective leadership and career development for employees, employment law, government regulations. They help you avoid litigation. They help you hire the most qualified employees, help with pre-planning for staffing needs, help with the effective internal processes when you're hiring employees. They help increase your visibility as an employer for recruiting. They help you identify the best and most cost-effective recruitment sources that are out there, and those are ever-evolving, particularly with technology. I know LinkedIn's become really big in recent years, and we do have a LinkedIn page, but we haven't had the time to really actively put it to use. And they help you do more thorough reference checks. And for us, it's just a matter of where we find the time to do all of these things. And we do our best to prioritize where we need to go, when we need to go there, but we could be a lot more proactive. So retaining our employees is also a high priority for us, and we want to make sure that we have effective leadership qualities in our managers so that they're well-trained as well as they possibly can be, that we're providing competitive wages and benefits along the lines of that, that we have effective labor relations. In the state of Washington, we're a very labor-intensive state. We have a lot of unionized employees when you look at our overall employment numbers. We do have over 100 employees. Doug mentioned this to you previously, but that's often a threshold where organizations will shift to creating an HR function. It's important that employees get relevant feedback from their supervisors. That's an area that we're really trying to step up our game right now, but that hasn't been a regular practice in the city. It's also important that supervisors get regular feedback from their employees, and that also has not been a regular practice. So we're working on putting those systems in place so we're in a better place, but having an HR professional would accelerate that and improve those processes quickly. And it's really an important function for helping with two-way communication just between employees and management in general, and just overall communication across departments and organization-wide. And a really important piece of your risk management team. So that's my pitch, at least for the HR manager role. There are comparable cities that we work with. When we do bargaining, we look at other cities that are similar to us and look at wages in those cities to help determine what's an appropriate wage for different types of positions in our city. And looking at our other communities that we compare to, there are five of them, and of the five, four of them have an HR function. So, again, just kind of brings home the fact that we're of that level now of community where it is common and it's a need for us. So in terms of the salary range, we've actually looked at those comparable cities and what they pay their folks, and we're thinking it's somewhere between $7,800 and about $9,000 per month for this position, plus benefits. You can add about a third for benefits on top of that. So that's would be partially in the general fund, but some of it would be allocated out to the utilities.
What cities are you comparing us to?
So we're compared to, when we do negotiations, we're looking at Steilacoom, Yelm, Anacortes, Stanwood, and Ferndale.
Yes. So this would be a full-time employee. Have you thought about contracting it out like we do with our lawyer and how much that would cost versus what you're doing here?
It's something we can look at. It's not something that, since I've been here in the last few weeks, that I have looked at or been involved in looking at. I'm not sure.
I'd like to see the prices on that and what it would equate to, because that would, benefits, things like that. And
So we actually have. We went out for somebody in HR to help us write one of our policy manuals, and so we have hired her to do that, but she's terribly busy. And we did ask her if she'd be willing to come on as a contracted HR person, and she just does not. And so then we approached her about people that she knows in this area who may be available, and she didn't know of anybody because everybody is slammed. So that's kind of just surface. We haven't really dug deep into that. But yeah, we have checked into that. That's a great suggestion. We have thought about that and looked into that. And we can continue to do that. But we have tried with that. So.
Okay.
But Charlie, you're looking at, what, 132 to 144,000 a year with benefits?
Yeah. In the ballpark, yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
What are they making over at SCAF for HR? SCAF Transit.
Thank you. To me. Yeah, we can certainly take a look at some of the other regional comparisons.
I mean,
as well.
You start comparing, look at the whole market, and I'm sure Skagit Transit doesn't pay 144.
Well, that's not the salary that we quoted. That's the total.
Well, that's package. With the package, and that's not taking, you know, vacation time, et cetera, et cetera. That's just compensation and benefits, probably.
Yeah, I have a friend who works for a city in HR, and she approximately $80,000 a year plus benefits.
You know, it's worth looking into. I can't see just going out and saying, "Hey, we got $130,000 or $145,000 we want to throw at you."
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It is. Especially when I think there's a need. I think we have to be really smart about. There are so many different places that could use extra help, and we're getting a lot. I feel like we're getting a lot. Of directors, but not enough people to implement the changes that they want to see. So
I don't want to chump them, but I don't want to reward them with the golden parachute, from the first day of work. So.
Understood. No, we can definitely take a look at some additional local comparators. We can definitely take a look at some other options. This is why we wanted to have this discussion.
Or
so
even
some
the
feedback.
Board of Skagit County or the Board of Vancouver. Bellingham or Port of Anacortes or whatever, they're all quasi-government. And they pay a decent wage and they hang on to their employees.
Mm-hmm. You said there's one that's not got an HR right now. What is the size of that town?
That's Ferndale. And off the top of my head, I'm not sure what their population is, but I think it's pretty
similar.
Similar.
So these cities that were chosen are similar budgets that that our city has. So that's why you choose your comparative, so that your funding models are similar. So that's one of the.
I just look at some of that and just want to make sure we're not being compared to certain cities that are down south where the cost of living is so much different.
Oh, right.
So, it totally throws it off the market where I realize that it's really hard to find people lately to fill positions. And the labor prices are going up immensely. So I just wanting to make sure we're comparing things appropriately to, our region, our county, this area. Appropriately, because again, the cost of living is fluctuating and not comparable to what it is down south.
Is it possible to do a partnership with Ferndale to have part-time down here, part-time up there with a unified HR to start, see what the effectiveness is, see what that looks like for the cities, to give them a good chance to see what an HR would help them possibly, and give us time to possibly think about.
Yeah, we can call them and explore that with them. Absolutely. You can contract in all different ways, including some of the agencies that were mentioned as well. There may be the opportunity to contract with them for time.
I really see having an HR person as it's being responsible to the citizens and being mindful of what we're doing here. And an HR person can actually act in an independent manner, where instead of our city administrator and our director of finance having to have to make some of those decisions that also influence their departments or could influence certain situations, having somebody who's independent does keep us transparent with the community. And it's, and legally speaking, it really keeps us it keeps us closer to being free and clear of any kind of lawsuits or legal situations, because they're overseeing that and they're looking at that. So I have been pushing for an HR person since I came on as mayor. I just think it's really important. We just haven't ever had the money. Doug did work to set aside money to get us started with that. That was one thing when he came on a couple years ago. I asked him if he could do that, and so he did that. He did what he could do. So it's, I hear you as far as we do need those workers out there, but I think what Charlie has shared as far as what an HR person does, that is a tremendous amount of work that could be very beneficial to the efficiency of our city. And I just think that's really smart to do if we're in charge of public funds.
Mm-hmm.
Who currently is handling like the LNI and all of that sort of stuff that comes through the city, since there is nobody in HR?
Finance, or payroll clerk, a payroll clerk.
So you guys have a lot of hats.
Yeah.
See, I see the value in the position. It's just how much value.
That's all I'm trying to say is find the best way to be able to incorporate it, but not at the highest price. To encourage people to apply. It comes at a cost.
I don't want them to outer on you, Charlie.
I think these are great suggestions.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think we hear support for the position. Just we need to figure out how we actually implement the position. Mm-hmm. We'll come back. Yeah, we'll be talking about this for a bit. So don't. Yeah, we're not running out and doing anything.
we greatly appreciate the feedback. Yes.
Just one other question: is there a big pay difference usually between like the private sector HR managers and public sector?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There is.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's important to not compare private sector wages to public sector, or is that a fair comparison?
You could probably when you're just doing position to position, we could compare the private sector as well. Yeah.
Because there's like sites like salary.com and Glassdoor that you can build like what's the average
profiles
salary for this area.
Yeah, exactly. Those are influenced by Seattle, so it's very. I mean, but yes, you can, but they become.
And I'm definitely not an expert in the field, but as a board member in the last couple of years for Skagit 911, they started an HR director position, and they funded it at $86,000 a year plus benefits, and it was filled for 2 months, mm-hmm. 3 months, and they have not been able to fill that position since. It's still open.
Yeah,
it's a tough one.
And that's for about a third of the employees that we oversee here, and it's tough to find someone.
It is.
So I don't know if that to me sounds like it's not necessarily a salary-based decision as to why it's not filled. Would that be correct assumption?
I think that there's so many jobs in that field right now that the demand is so high that they're able to pick and choose what they want. And this person, they ended up recruiting and got from Colorado and didn't last. You were on the board when that started.
I was on the board, it didn't. But also the discussion was when, as we sat on the board, we were talking about the income. Mm-hmm. Oh, we had the same discussion that you all are having. So I hear you clearly. I know exactly where you're coming from. And there were people on the board then who said that it was too low. And
they wanted it higher than 86.
And
the 86 was where they met. And are still not able to fulfill it and keep it filled, so the retention is still an issue.
We'll definitely do our research on it and bring back options. But this has been a great discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, it becomes very difficult when you're looking at this. You're looking at the pay scales. You're looking at everything, and then you're recruiting, and then you're getting people like from Colorado or from all these places that aren't here. And then our traditions kind of slowly go away because there's different things that come up in. You know, what somebody might believe to be a liability or this or that or the other. And so we kind of start to lose our identity in that as well. So that is also one of my concerns.
So you read about the culture here? Is that what I hear you say?
I do a little bit. I absolutely support HR. I think it's absolutely necessary I'm actually surprised that it's not a position and hasn't been. I've worked in both private and public sectors, and I've never been anywhere that didn't have HR, except at a local law office that had 10 employees. I mean, that's different. I just think that we need to be very aware as well that when we're looking for these people, we're doing these things, that we're not sacrificing our tradition and our community and our values as we're trying to evolve and get up to date and up to speed with where we need to be as a city.
That's good. Yeah. And definitely make sure someone fits our culture. I mean, I think it's really critical.
I mean, that's why I would assume that's why you guys came here to begin with, right? You know?
Exactly.
And that's why people
you do get
here.
I mean, obviously, hopefully if we get an HR manager hired, we know the right questions to answer. I mean, I think there are ways. But thank you. That's really good. Good thoughts.
Can I piggyback off that for 1 second since we're talking about hiring and that? One thing that my constituents and myself
Hometown Hospitality is the, what is that called? The phone tree. Okay? So much so that I'm thinking, how can we talk to Ellen at the Senior Center to find a lady who just wants to be helpful and answer the phones for volunteer to, so that we have that, hi, City of Cedar Woolley, and they just moved here. And do you know what? We've got a really great Greek restaurant. We're missing so many opportunities to connect with people because I want to chuck the phone by the time I've reached my destination. So if they need extra help, perhaps maybe there's a grandma who wants to help us who's retired. Or can we facilitate something to eliminate that and make the other girls not make a burden for them to answer it, but find help for them so that we can eliminate.
I'm not going to lie, I've hung up several times trying to call because I had questions, and I thought, oh, I'll just call Debbie, and then I hung up because I got so frustrated.
Yeah. And we're like,
I'll just wait till the meeting.
And you know it. You and you know where you want to go.
Yes, and you don't know how to do it.
So I had a call from Pola this morning. I'm just going to interject here. I had a call from Pola this morning, Chamber. Mm-hmm. She was trying to get a hold of somebody down in finance, and she had tried the phone tree and was extremely frustrated. And so she called my number directly. She called my personal cell, is what she did. And I gave her the extension number. I said, do the number and do the extension. Yep. But yeah, it is. I know it is frustrating. We did talk about this at manager's meeting. We said it does need to be. We know it needs to be cleaned up and changed.
We have to be customer friendly.
Yes. I think there was a great job done in bringing it forward from the first time. I think it's much better than it was, but you're right. There's still, I mean, even if I didn't know people's cell numbers, I'd be frustrated too. I'd want to check my phone too.
Yeah, I'm like, please,
thank you. We've got a couple more positions to talk about if you want to move on. I'm going to turn it over to Mark on Zoom to talk about the two public works positions.
Thank you, Charlie. Good evening. The story on our position that we're talking about, we have been advertising actually for a position we're calling a senior engineer / assistant city engineer position. A little background on that. We've been working fairly short-staffed in engineering for several years. We've tried to hire on two separate occasions. First, we were going for a junior level engineer that we could train up. We hired one. He lasted 2 weeks and smelled the grass greener in Seattle and moved away. We were far into our construction season by the time all that took place and didn't attempt to fill that again that particular year and got through. Then COVID came into play and we didn't try anything in 2020. We have continued to be successful at funding projects here in the town and in the city, and just to give you an idea of what's on the books right now, I'll just give you a quick rundown. We have the SR-20, SR-9 intersection improvements project, which council awarded on the 10th of November, and contracts are being signed tomorrow, and we'll be ready to move ahead with that. That project will build in 2022, we hope. There is some question on acquisition of signal poles, which are subject to some COVID supply chain issues. But regardless of that, that's a management project for us. We have the existing Cascade Trail Extension project David's been designing on for a couple of years that will continue in the design phase. We have the two TIB projects that we were awarded. We haven't gotten the contracts yet, but I expect those in the next couple of weeks. One of those is a $2.7 million intersection improvement project at SR-9 and John Liner and McGargle, which is desperately needed, and we're very grateful that that's been funded. That's going to take a considerable amount of staff time to manage and take forward. That one we'll design in 2022 and construct hopefully in 2023. We also got a TIB grant for $282,000 for an overlay on Trail Road, which we typically design in-house. David's been doing those just about every other year as we've had funding to do those. We have, as you know, the $6.3 million wastewater treatment plant public works building project that's under construction right now. contractor, we had our first on-site meeting today, and they're moving along quickly. They've poured the foundations and are working on the stem walls for the first of the buildings. They're pouring that tomorrow, actually, and we'll be starting on the other one soon. And they'll be out of the ground and starting to put up wood on that probably within a month or so. So those things are going to shape up pretty quickly. That project is a 350-day project, a calendar day project, so it'll complete sometime in late 2022. We have, as we've discussed in our various meetings we've had in the past year on the sewer utility, quite an aggressive program at the wastewater treatment plant on two fronts. First, we have our normal collection system projects, which we budget about $400,000 a year for collection system upgrades. In the past, we've designed those in-house. David Lee has done those. We weren't able to do it in 2021 due to workload. We have just simply been too busy for David to take the time out to do that. So that's doubled the amount of projects we are looking at for 2022, up to over $600,000 for that. We also have, as you know, a variety of treatment plant capacity projects that we need to get done over the next 3 to 4 years before we get into the facility planning stage at the plant. Plus the planning for that future project is a pretty busy undertaking that I generally handle. But those treatment plant projects, we've got a smaller one planned for 2022 and then a large one for 2023. 2 years in a row, there's going to be a significant management required at the treatment plant. In addition to that, we're hoping to get about a $700,000 TIB Complete Streets grant, which we'll use part of that money to provide the rest of the funding for the Cascade Trail Extension project that I mentioned earlier, which if we're successful with that, we'll be doing that project potentially in 2023 as well. In addition to that, we help Nathan out with the street maintenance projects. We both help with the design and bidding of those internally, and as well as the construction management and inspection of those. So Wally generally does that for us. And finally, if you haven't had enough of a view on what's going on, there's Olmsted Park. We're in the final design for that $1.4 million project. We expect to have the plans and be ready to go advertise for that in sometime in early 2022. Altogether, that adds up to about $13.9 million in projects that I see that are on the books, by the way. These are not guesses or pie in the sky over the period 2022 to 2023. And I just see it continuing on for several years. I didn't even mention the Jones-John Liner Trail Corridor project, but in addition to the other things we're doing here, we're managing the property acquisition for the Nelson parcel that we've talked about, and coordinating with the Bucko family for a section of the corridor which will pass over their property. And we're very close to completing the development agreement, and I think you're going to see that at the next council meeting. I believe that's coming up shortly. So there's just a lot of things hopping here. In addition to all of those things that are actually our own projects, between David and I, we're managing the review of development projects from the engineering standpoint. In addition to the Bucko project, which has been an all hands on deck endeavor for David and I over the last 6 or 8 months, RJ Group is looking to drop a plat anytime for extension to Portobello so that they can do the Duke's Hill portion of that development that's been in the works for many years. But they're ready to go on that. And we've been working back and forth with them to figure out how the roads are going to connect in. Our transportation plan calls for extension of Portobello to Highway 9. And there were some aspects of their annexation agreement from back in 2005 that required them to participate in getting that road over. And we're working closely with them on that. That's going to take some more hand-holding over the next year. RJ is also doing, as you know, the five-story combined apartment building and commercial space on Hodgen Street. They've got a next phase of that, that they're getting ready to drop some plans our way on that. We've had two preliminary application meetings on that now. That's another one that we're having to pay very close attention to because our comprehensive transportation plan calls for extension of Hodgen Road up to Cook. And so we're working closely with them on making sure that their project takes that into account or mitigates for it. So development review is a heavy, heavy part of our workload right now, as it is also for John Coleman and his team at building and planning. I've been maintaining a spreadsheet. We actually talked about this at some length back in March when we were getting close to picking up an engineer at that time, a local fellow that had expressed some interest to, after that decided to pursue other interests. So we went through this not that long ago, and I went in before this meeting and updated the spreadsheet that I prepared for Doug back then to demonstrate what kind of hours or days we saw that we could use another engineer for. Basically, back then, we were ready to do it. And it's over 300 man days for 2022 and about 270 for 2023. To put that in perspective for you, that's what I could use another man for. If we don't have another man, then David and I have to do it in addition to the duties that we already have. So the justification is there. I haven't done all the math that Debbie will need to see for budget purposes, but my previous look at that demonstrated that we could pretty well pay for the position out of development fees and the engineering expenses that we normally allow on our design projects. Pretty sure we can cover all or a very good portion of that with the dollars that will be coming to play with those projects. So Charlie and I and the mayor met yesterday and talked about this at some length, and certainly both of them are very supportive and have expressed their concern about the workload here. And we've been asked to look at what we can cut, and I'm doing that. If for some reason we can't fill this, and the last part of this story is we've actually been advertising for that position for about 2 months now, and we have had no qualified applicants for that. So it's a challenging thing. So that was an interesting discussion about the HR manager, because certainly that's something that a person that's dedicated to do those kind of things would no doubt have helped. Basically, I've been taking the lead on that up to now and in my spare time. So, and I wish I could say that I've been all in on that, but as you know, there's other things that happen with this position, and we've tried all the avenues we know of. So some more professional help with that would probably be quite helpful. And I know that now that Charlie's on, he's going to be looking closely at following up on that. So that's the long and short of that position. There's more than enough justification to move ahead with that as expeditiously as we can. The flip side of that is we clone myself and David and try to keep doing it as we have been doing it somewhat successfully. But we are getting tired. I'll be honest with you about that. And we could use the help. These are all good, important projects for the city. The federal aid portion of the projects, they're difficult to stop the train on once you start them. Pretty much you got to spend them within a certain amount of time and make those happen. So the two intersection projects and the trail project are in that classification. Now we have the two TIB projects that are kind of the same thing. They're both trains that are on the track, and they will need to keep moving. We don't really want to stop those unless we absolutely have to. We could probably defer or delay treatment plant projects again. Dangerous for us now, as I've been expressing to you, just because of the age of our plant. These extreme storms we've been seeing the last few years, I think we can expect that's going to continue. The projects that we've completed over the last 3 years have really helped with that. We've been able to weather these storms without having to have a crew out there watching the water rising in our weir box every night when we're having these storm events. We've solved that problem, and we've made good progress on our aeration system too, but there's still a number of other things that need to happen to just preserve the plant capacity we've got now. So we don't want to stop unless we absolutely have to. So I've said a lot of words. I'd be glad to take any questions on that. I know you all have heard me talking about this quite a bit over the year.
Hey, Mark, I've got a question.
Carl has a question.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for that robust and comprehensive report. Did I miss on transportation benefit district projects? I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that on our third part of our agenda, but maybe you could touch a little bit about what's on the docket and what's needed with that funding. Thank you.
Well, that funding is basically divided up into two parts. We have generally received about $200,000 a year in TBD funds, and we've typically split them. We've used half for the match fund money for, like, the trail road overlay we're talking about. That's what will match those dollars from TIB. And then the other half we put into using as match funds for, the other half we use for arterial maintenance projects, overlays and things like that beyond the TIB type projects. So it's scarce dollars that we put to use, you know, every time we have them available. We stretch them as far as we can. And so those projects are kind of covered in the bigger, broader buckshot load I gave you on the projects we've got going.
Is there anybody else having questions? Thank you, Mark. That was very comprehensive. Yes.
One more. He's got one more to talk about.
Okay.
Mark, do you have the last position? Do you want to talk about that this evening as well? The one in the Public Works Operations area?
Yes. So, as you know, we've been working fairly shorthanded on Public Works Operations, particularly for stormwater and parks, for some time. We've been able to backfill a position or two over the last few years that we had lost back in 2008. Nathan expresses rather eloquently at any opportunity that we still haven't completely made operations whole from what we were before the Great Recession. I think we're pretty close on that, but what I can say with a great deal of passion is that the workload for our crew has continued to grow. And I know you recognize that. We've been with Nathan's leadership, we've added another park to our inventory in our Hauser Park, and now within a year, Olmsted should be operational as well. And those all take quite a bit of maintenance to keep up. You know, we'll have hopefully, if we are successful with the federal funds that Representative Larson is shepherding through the Congress, the ability to build a caretaker's residence, and that will help some with that. That's what we do at Memorial, and that's what we do at Riverfront and at Bingham. But still, the grass has to be mowed and the equipment maintained and all of those things. And we see that there's the justification, definitely the justification for another position within operations. It would be split somewhat between the parks type part of the operation and stormwater, is what I understand is the way the budget is being looked at. We've talked at length on the timing of that. It would be nice to have them now. We understand the budget limitations, but I think it's pretty well vital that we have somebody back on or on to add to our staff there by the 2023. And that just is related to that's when the newest park opens up, and it's going to become pretty difficult to adequately maintain our perk system once we have that in place. So that's the long and short of that position.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mark? Thank you, Charlie.
Move on.
Yep.
Okay, so the next item on here is Fire District 8 and an interlocal agreement with Fire District 8. So Chief Wagner and I are going to walk through that and do our best to talk it through with you. Our apologies for getting the agreement to you a little late. It didn't go in the initial packet. That's because there were still conversations going on with District 8. There were still some drafts going back and forth. But it was in the amended packet that went out yesterday. So we'll kind of go through a little bit of the history. We've been working with Fire District 8 for a very long time. Frank can tell you, I mean, what, the entire time you've been with us.
I've been here for 27 years, and we've been with them longer than that. And as most of you know, we kind of the municipality sits right in the middle of Fire District 8's response area. So they have all of the area around us to the west, all the way to District Line Road. They go all the way to the north of the Whatcom County line on Highway 9, and their area also goes to the east up past Hamilton. So they have four stations in those areas. Two of them are up to the north of us, one on Highway 9, which is called the Prairie Station. One's on Prairie Road in the Hickson area, which is the Hickson Station. And then they have two more stations to the east. One they rent from the town of Lyman, and the other building is right there on Highway 20 at Cabin Creek, across from Janicki's new building there on the north side of Highway 20. They are totally volunteer except for their current chief, who was a 30-year member of our department and just took on up there, Josh Carpenter. In the entire time that I've been here, we have always had a partnership and an agreement to provide services for them, because a lot of their area, from District Line in the middle between us and Burlington, this direction, they have no station, no volunteers or anybody to cover those areas, as well as that same area from the city limits to the east up to Minkler Road. So those areas there, including Backus Hill, the reservation, what up until a couple years ago, Northern State was not in the city. We've covered all primary response for fire and emergency services without them coming at all. And we've had a contract with them for as long as I can remember. It hasn't been addressed or changed or any monetary upgrades to that in years. They have also helped subsidize and pay for part of our part-timers over the years. And during COVID, before COVID started, we actually sat down and started looking at a new agreement. That was pushed back, and the agreement was extended because of all the happenings with COVID and them having a retirement at their chief level with Rusty Fay, and our chief, Mr. Klinger, retiring as well. So we did a one-year extension. We've been working on this on and off for the last 6 months. Charlie has been, like, working 15, 16 hours a day, 50 calls a day to try to get this down before the 11th hour. But the agreement we have in place in front of us, as Charlie can speak to with the numbers and stuff, but they need us. We aren't totally reliant on them, but we've had such a great partnership and relationship with them. We're kind of like the family culture you've talked about. We share a lot of their people. Some of our residents are do both. We have fires during the day. They help us. We have fires in the night and stuff. We kind of work together. They're able to come in and work on our rigs and vice versa. So it's been a very beneficial relationship over the 30 years, and I think us and them both agree we want to continue that. Unfortunately or fortunately, when the forefathers had started this way back when, I think some of the agreements were done on a napkin, and we needed to upgrade some of those contractual language. And whether they liked it or not, it was kind of time to increase the rates. And one of the things that you'll see in the contract there as far as dollars go, we broke down by call of what the cost is for us as far as fire and EMS budget. And when you look at that, we're running 3,500 calls a year. So we looked at, it's about $1,058 per call as far as our services. And that doesn't include all the extra stuff that we have as far as, you know, Nathan and his crew, the centralized services, the IT. So just fire alone, we're costing about $1,058 for each one of those calls. Well, we run over 700 calls a year that are for or with Fire District 8. One of the things that we have, as most of you know, about 3 years ago, we took on the paramedic services and the BLS transport stuff from the county. And we get a subsidy that EMS levy to pay for that. Well, their constituents also pay into that same EMS levy and are paying for that. So one of the stipulations or one of the things that they were kind of looking at is, why should their people pay for a service that's already being subsidized by their tax dollars, and we're going to provide whether we have this contract or not? Which they're right. So to be fair, we kind of broke that down as, and I took out all of the transport revenue, the EMS dollar revenue, and brought that out, and we got that fire-only emergency services deal without the ambulance stuff in there, and brought it down to for the same calls per year, taking out all that revenue that we wouldn't see if we weren't running that service for them, and brought it down to $513 per call is our deal. And we're running a little over 700 calls a year, so Charlie can speak to the numbers and stuff, but we think we've got a pretty good contract in here. We got some better language to cover them and us as far as liabilities and how operations are being done. We're no longer looking at sharing them paying for half of our part-time services, because as you know, we kind of have that super hybrid system where we have some volunteers, we have some folks that live here at the stations that are working through college and stuff to help subsidize. We have some new career staff over the last few years, and as we progress, how we're operating and how we're running, especially with staffing concerns that we've been talking about for the last 6 months, are ever changing. So right now we're providing a pretty darn good service for a low rate. We want to continue that, but we don't want to be held to a contract where we have to send a part-timer or a part-timer only, like some of this stuff had said before. We need to operate with some autonomy and be able to make the decisions that we want to make that's best for them and keep coverage here as well. So we're not sending people, we don't want to send four or five people to a call in their area when we can do it with two. And that helps them for the second call and the third call that we're often having. When I started here 27 years ago, we were excited to get to one call a day. And now we're averaging almost 10, and sometimes 20 to 30 a day. So we got to be able to manage two, three, four calls at once sometimes. And we're providing that EMS services to anywhere in the county, depending on the needs of the system. So
District 8 was interested in a flat fee, and we were interested in simplifying the contract in some of the ways the chief mentioned. So rather than having them fund our part-time firefighters, we took that money and applied it to the per-call rate that the chief mentioned. And we looked at the average number of calls that we've done for District 8 in the last 3 years. So we took the 666 from 2019, 766 from 2020, 772 that we projected for 2021. We averaged those out to 735 calls. That's our three-year average. And we use that as the basis, times $513 a call, to develop the flat fee. And then they had a edit to that, in that there are certain calls that they felt they could handle themselves in the district that they weren't handling previously. Those are classified as non-emergent calls. And so we had a discussion about that. They thought that number is about 72 calls per year. So we took our 735 and deducted 72 off of it, which is a reduction in revenue for us, but also means we're not responding to the district, so our units are more available to city residents and for other needs. So that got us down to $663. That was our 663 calls was our revised number of calls per year. That we applied to do the base rate for each of the 3 years at $513 a call. In further negotiations, we told them we were concerned that those 72 calls they deducted wouldn't actually all be calls that we wouldn't have to respond to because of the nature of the calls. Sometimes they'll send them, they'll send us, and they agreed to essentially pay us for 15 of those calls. So that helped. So that actually bumped the numbers up a little bit. And we're still concerned about that number, so we got them to agree to open the contract in 6 months. Essentially, we will sit down in 6 months and look at the actual numbers. How are those calls working out? Have they been able to respond to them or not? And then we'll true the numbers up for years 2 and 3 if we need to change them, which we almost guaranteed will, because the number's not going to be the 15-week, unless we had a perfect crystal ball, I'd be shocked. That never works out that way. So likely years 2 and 3, they'll go up or down. If we had a crystal ball on that, we think that the revenue for us will probably go up on those, because we'll probably be responding to more of those calls than they projected. So with that said, we ended up with, at least for year one, and I wrote this into the cover memo, we anticipate $347,814 in revenue from this contract. And then the escalator per year for this amount is 2%, which I also had some concerns with, just in terms of where inflation's running currently. They wanted some predictability, and so we went for 2% applied from 22 to 23. This is a three-year contract. 2% applied at that point from 22 to 23, but in 23 we would have a discussion about where we are on that and see what inflation is actually running and whether or not from 23 to 24 we need to increase that amount. But if you assume 2%, we'd be at 347,000 in 22, 354,000 in 23, 361,000 in 24. And that's without the 15 call, the deduction on calls, without that getting adjusted at all. That's just assuming that it was 15 calls every year. So the other piece of this that's interesting from a revenue perspective for the city, and this is all general fund money, is that the way the current contract works, there's a tail on the billing. So the quarters that we are paid for that show up in our budget this year, the actual first quarter payment that comes in from the district is from last year's calls, last year fourth quarter. So what's going to happen when we switch this is we switch the way the payments are made. They want to make the payments within the actual calendar year, which is good for us in the first year, because we'll get all four quarters paid for next year in 22, and they'll be split up a certain way that we put in the contract. They're just going to divide it by four and pay us in equal installments. And we'll also get the fourth quarter of this year coming in, which is about $80,000 we anticipate. So next year should be a pretty good budget year when it comes to this contract, and then it'll drop down quite a bit after that, but we'll still gradually go up. So we feel this is a fair contract. It's simplified. One of the things the chief talked about a fair amount is the amount of back and forth on the current contract they have over individual calls and how much to charge for it or how much not. The $260 in the current contract isn't just a straight rate. There are all kinds of caveats to it, depending on the number of hours the response was and everything else. So we're really, really just trying to simplify things going forward. It's a three-year contract, and then we'll be sitting down with them potentially and talking again about the future. And there have been discussions that they've had in the past about possibly having us provide services for them, and I'm sure they're thinking also about possibly doing their own call someday. So that's where we are, and it's been a long-standing relationship, and the phrase I've been using this week a lot with the mayor is my hair's been on fire a little bit trying to get this done, because this thing expires at the end of the year. There's not a desire by the district to put an extension on it for a few months or anything like that. We just wanted to get it done if we could. So we wanted to bring it to you tonight essentially as a first reading, get any feedback from you that we could, and then bring it back for action next week.
Chief Wagner, just real quick, do you think it's workable? Do you think it's fair? And will it provide the services that they need and we do as a city?
Very much so. I think, obviously we're not going to be making a ton of money or anything on this, but it's gonna help subsidize what we're doing, what we're trying to do going forward. And with this new language, like right now what we're currently in, what we have been for the last, 10 years, is we've been doing this part-time program Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. They've been paying for half of those folks. And with that, we've been guaranteeing that we would send two people plus a battalion sometimes, and currently these last 3 years, a medic unit too. So if they have a call up in Lyman or way up on Highway 9, we're sending five folks to these calls. And sometimes we really could probably only send two and be good. And we'll still have the autonomy to send those extra folks if needed. This is going to allow us to keep two or three of those back on those calls that can get warranted. And so in long term, it's going to be better for us and them, because that second or third call could very well be at the other end of their own district.
Are you going to take a pack of napkins to have everything inked, and you'll just give us each a new contract?
Hometown value.
I did want to offer one last thing, and that is in 2021, the district is essentially done because of that billing I described that goes into, we're already in the fourth quarter, which will go into next year, but the contribution from the district to the city was $314,000. So we're going to go from $314,000 up to $347,000 plus the TAIL funding of $80,000. So
we'll get five payments next year.
We get five payments, but even if you looked at it straight across year to year, it's $314,000 to $347,000. Represents the discussions we've certainly had about trying to pay fair costs. All right, thank you. That was one more item. Just run with it.
Yep, go ahead, the legislative right. Priorities.
Yes, so one of the first things that I was asked to do when I got here, and got a little bit waylaid on it, but is to work with the city staff and all of you on developing legislative priorities for this upcoming state legislative session. And you probably know of our state lobbyist, but if not, we have a state lobbyist, Mark Struli, who does work for us. And historically, we have paid him to advocate for capital projects that we're trying to get funded. So he's not, I would say, we're not paying him as like a full-time lobbyist, we're paying him as a part-time lobbyist on very specific things. And with that said, we developed a legislative agenda, and this was primarily me working with Mark, and Mark having all the knowledge on the projects, a lot of the ones he mentioned previously. But we did add a wrinkle to it this year, something a little bit different, and that is we've got an agenda that's got a couple of projects on it and then some other things we think of note. But we added to that legislative priorities from the Association of Washington Cities. And every city in the state belongs to AWC. And AWC every year has a legislative process whereby they try to work with a large committee to develop an agenda that represents the interests of all the cities in the state. And they've got really effective lobbyists, and they will go after trying to get these things done on our behalf. And they will also ask us when we're a part of the city's legislative action days, when we work with AWC, to carry the AWC flag and carry these issues forward on their behalf. So we thought it would be a good idea, and what I've done in previous cities is ask the council to consider supporting AWC's legislative agenda as well as a part of this. So we included that in there for you. There are really three main categories for that, and then we'll jump into the Cedar Willy projects. The first is enhancing basic infrastructure funding, and that typically falls into state programs that fund infrastructure, like the Public Works Trust Fund and things of that nature. So leave that to you to look more into it, but you know, drinking water and water, wastewater funding, and so on and so forth. So that enhancing basic infrastructure funding is the number one category. Protecting the Transportation Benefit District Funding Authority is the second one, and that really is focusing in on sales tax from voted transportation benefit districts. And I was in this situation in my previous city where you get a voted transportation benefit district for a period of 10 years when it gets voted in, and then it expires after 10 years. You can renew it once, but you can't renew it more than once. So even if your community loves it, like ours did, where they renewed it by 72% the first time, it's over when it's over, and that's just the way state law is set up. So AWC is trying to change that, and cities are supportive of that, and I would encourage you all to support really anything that gives us more tools or more extensive tools, particularly if our residents want to support them, which we would have to do if we had a voted transportation benefit district, go to them and ask. And then the last is passing a transportation package, which ties directly to our project that's in the transportation category, which is the Jones-John Liner Trail Corridor project. It's directly tied to getting funding from that in all likelihood. And this is something the legislature's been talking about the last several years, but hasn't actually taken action on to really do what they need to do to get it through. It would involve a tax increase. They've talked about a gas tax the last few sessions, but again, nothing's happened. So those are the items on there, and so in passing the legislative agenda, we're asking you to consider supporting the AWC legislative priorities as part of that, and we can strip that off if you don't want to support them as well, but I wanted to take a minute to introduce those and I'm happy to talk more about those. But if you'd like, I'll scroll down to the projects we've got on here for Cedar Woolley, and then we can talk about any questions you might have. And for that, I'm going to turn it over to our expert, Mark Freiberger, on Zoom.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. Bill, if you could go ahead and scroll up a page. One more, please. That's the fire district agenda there. There should be one called 2022 State Legislative Priorities. Keep going. There you go. Okay, so basically there's two different elements of the budget that we would request your permission to carry to the legislature this year. The first one is a repetition of what we've done in three other sessions now. That is in either the transportation budget, which I have listed on the form, or the transportation package that Charlie just talked about in the AWC priorities, to fund all or a portion of the Jones-John Liner Trail Corridor projects. I've given you a little breakdown here on where we're at right now. 3 years ago, when we first carried this to legislature, our project was about a $32.5 million project. And we were asking essentially for the whole enchilada at that time. We were seeking to do that. And we did okay. We were actually included in the Senate version of the transportation package that Senator Hobbs, who's now our Attorney General, was sponsoring. And so we've carried this to the legislature in the subsequent two sessions. The time before last, it was still up in the $30 million range in their package that did not clear the Senate Transportation Committee. And then this last year, it moved along rather well, but at a reduced rate. They actually had this in the transportation budget at $15 million that was actually on Governor Inslee's desk for signature. And of course, he line item vetoed that part out, and so we missed the mark once again. No pun intended. So here we are again, and the project, as you would expect, has grown somewhat with inflation. I have not updated the estimates significantly since they were last updated in 2020, but based on those figures, we're at a $35 million total project now, as opposed to 32.5 when we started this several years ago. And I'm a little concerned. In fact, I'm relatively certain with the inflation we've saw in the last 9 months that this figure is going to probably go up even more. But right now, this is what we have to work with. Now, we've been successful with completing or getting commitments on a significant part of these projects, and I've got those listed up in the top part. The Jones-John Liner undercrossing, as you know, we did get $850,000 at the last session, or actually two sessions ago, for funding the BNSF undercrossing work. Now, as a practical matter, when we got into the weeds on that project, it didn't make any sense to actually put the bridge deck in place. But we did, working with BNSF, came into agreement to have them drive the piles and to purchase the bridge decks, which they've done. And we used about $400,000, a little less than that, about $350,000 of the grant to do that work. And so we have about $350,000 or so left in that kitty that we've spoken to Senator Wagner about that, and he's supportive of us using those funds to continue the environmental and design phase work to further refine what we need to do at both the Sap Road crossing and the Jones-John Liner connection to move that project a little farther along. And so it's in my corner to write a supplemental agreement for DOT Rails to review. I have talked to them about this, and they're supportive of it as well. We think with legislative support, we'll be successful on that. And that will be another item then we would be looking to select a consultant or consultants for to do some work in 2022. The grant is still active through the end of 2022, so that's the timeline that we have for that particular money. And so that's the $484,000 completed project. C1B is $484,000 of that $850,000. I had the number right in front of me there. The next project is the Cook Road Trail Road intersection, and this just represents the Nelson acquisition, which council has been vitally involved in. We're in the condemnation process on that, as you know. Nikki's working hard to get the letters out to the folks that may be a party to the succession of that Nelson property. That's a vital acquisition, as we've expressed to you, that is tied intimately in with the Bucco development. We need to have this property in order to locate an intersection on Cook Road that will work for the arterial to go through their property and then on up to F&S Grade Road. And so the value of that's about $600,000+. The next project is the Trail Road Arterial Extension, the Bucco portion. And as I mentioned earlier, you're going to be seeing a developer's agreement on that. This represents the value of the work for that portion of the roadway as per the scoping study. The Bucco costs are going to be significantly less than that. That's one of the advantages of us working closely with the developers to further these projects when we can. That's the cost that it would be per our scoping study if we did it. And we're working with them to build a portion of that. And we are participating to an extent with that, with impact fees and other consideration that we'll discuss in the developer's agreement when you see that. The Trail Road Garden of Eden extension has already been built by BYK. Again, this is the value that's in the scoping study, $1.4 million. They built that road for us. We still have to put permanent intersections at Jones and at F&S Grade Road. Those are included in the other elements of the scoping study. And finally, as we just announced, the TIB funding for the intersection at SR9 and McGarrigle and John Liner is a $2.7 million project that we expect to see a contract on shortly. Those all add up to about $7.5 million of our $35 million total. So the remaining projects are listed there. I won't go through them individually, but they're about $27.5 million, and that we'll be requesting from legislature as support in a transportation package. If they do as they did last year and offer to furnish a part of these funds in the transportation budget itself, if they stayed at the $15 million level, that would get us significantly on the path here. And we would use those funds for a couple of purposes. We would build that last piece between Jones and the Bucco property and F&S Grade Road. That would be a necessary thing, right-of-way acquisition and construction of that. And then also the undercrossing and connection of the road from Reed Street to Sap Road and John Liner Road. Those two projects added together somewhere in the $14, $15 million range. So if we do come up with a number like that, that'll actually give us, with the Bucco project and some other things that need to happen, that would get us pretty close to having an operational corridor. There would still be some intersections that would need to be completed to make that completely functional. The primary one that I'm going to mention to you tonight, because I haven't said much about it, but Cook Road and Trail, with the change of the alignment that you've seen as we've been negotiating with the Buccos, we're going to end up with two separate intersection improvements there. The Cook and Trail Road intersection, the present one, is operating at an adequate level of service. It's stressed, especially in the peak hours. And as the detour that happened during the flood event showed, Cook Road, without the 16,000 vehicles a day or so that are going down SR20, gets very, very backed up. And it's something that I've been tasked by administration with talking to DOT about. And in fact, I'll mention it in a minute. That's one of the other projects by other agencies that we're going to express our support for and asking legislature to move forward with in terms of improvements at, I-5 and Cook Road, which is a necessary adjunct to this whole corridor that we're looking at here. So that's a very important project, and that after the funding of the SR9 and McGarrigle John Liner Road is going to become one of the primary vital projects to move forward with, rebuilding that existing intersection. And I do have those funds included in this corridor still, even though we're going to be building a second likely roundabout intersection at the new extension of Trail Road to the north and a Cook Road there on the east side of the school district property. The project that's called C3, the bottom of those remaining projects, is actually both of those projects combined. So that's that project, and we would ask your continued support with moving that forward. As we all know, the growth in Cedro Woolley and around Cedro Woolley is putting significant pressure on our transportation system. This is our 20-year plan to deal with this, is to build the corridor. And so it's pretty important that we continue with this project, moving it forward at every opportunity we have, such as with partnering with the developers, as we're talking about with BYK and Bucko. So if you can flip down to the second page of that bill, appreciate it. So the other ask, every year there is a capital budget request that's available for the agencies to make to our various legislators. The mayor's already met with Representative Eslick, and she can speak about that if she chooses to. We have settled in on funding the remainder of our public works facility upgrade. As you know, we came to you last year about a reduced project down there. We basically funded and are under construction for the public works / fleet building. The budget for that's about $4 million, a little less than that. You can see the numbers there on that. That's what's called alternate number one at $3.2 million. The site work, alternate number two, is also included in the existing local funding that we have, and that's about $588,000. The estimate that I have on this sheet for the remaining work to build the vehicle storage building, the final design and construction, it was $2.2 million when I prepared this memo a few days ago. I had Carletti working on an updated estimate for that building because I just used $150 a square foot for that, which in these times I wasn't comfortable with sticking with. I would have been 3 years ago. So Carletti gave me an order of magnitude estimate for that, and it went up by $900,000. So instead of a $2.2 million project, it's about $2.7 million. The total then is about, excuse me, I'm looking at the wrong sheet. 2.2, it's 3.1, $914,000 difference. And the overall estimated cost for the project is up to $6.8 million. So the second part of that layout there is the funding that we have. We have $4 million available from the OST local program funding it's a reimbursable thing. We've already, by the way, been reimbursed for our design work that we had already completed, which is good that we have that in place. We have, in addition to that, about $787,000 that are available between the Fund 505 beginning fund balance. And this represents the money that we've been setting aside from the three utilities and general fund to fund that OST money that we're talking about. And we also have accumulated another bit beyond what was in the beginning fund balance in 2021. Our first payment for the new loan, that's not the right term for it. They sell bonds for us. I'm sure Debbie can give us the correct wording on that. But that first payment doesn't take place until June of 2022. So I think we're rather safe to say that we have about $787,000 that would be available to use on our project. As I mentioned, we've already been reimbursed under the $4 million for the design phase for that building. So that money is pretty much free. and clear for using that way. That leaves the additional funding we need with that $900,000 change, I've told you, right at $2.06 million. And that's what we would propose to approach the legislature about, seeing if we can pick up all or a portion of those funds to finish this project. And that's the idea here. And what we're calling this is the final phase of the Public Works Facility Upgrade Project. We hope to demonstrate by what I've just talked to you about here, the efforts that the city has gone through to move this project forward. And we were cautioned by a representative of Eslick in particular last year that, you know, we really needed to show that we are have some skin in the game on this. And we believe that we have adequately and abundantly demonstrated that by what we show here. So we would ask your support to move forward with that ask to fund the rest of that project so that we can finish that project possibly in 2023 and be done with it. Other than that, we have some regional projects that we'll mention to the legislators. We've been working with, I sat on a review committee with DOT and Skagit County for a year or two, talking about the intersection at I-5 and Cook Road. And out of those meetings, DOT has come up with a practical solutions project, estimated at $6.5 million, that I've got in the description there. It's basically some additional lanes on Cook, signal sequencing, and then some on and off ramp metering that they would do at the intersection that their projections say would handle the increased volumes that we're seeing on that road and avoid some of the backups into I-5 that are currently occurring during the peak hours. I have to say the justification that DOT has come up for this project is pretty good, but they are competing with themselves because there are two other elements. They recently completed a corridor study that basically went from the south of the Skagit River Bridge up to Cook Road, and they looked at the hot spots in there in terms of accidents and congestion. The George Hopper intersection shows up as a much higher priority in terms of the accidents than this one does. The city of Burlington is actually working on a project they have partially funded to do some of the work that DOT would need to have done there. But there is another priority project there that might, in terms of what the legislature and DOT would push first, they may be well looking at doing that project first. The other one is College Way. Some improvements have just been completed by the city of Mount Vernon there to add the lanes on College Way, and that's helped quite a bit, but there's some congestion issues at that intersection as well, and high accident rates down in that direction. Cook Road, right now, we all can see a train wreck coming on that, but it really hasn't shown up in the accident data yet, and God willing it doesn't, but I think we all recognize that the risk is there at that intersection. But in terms of funding priorities, we may not quite meet the grade on that yet. But we're going to make the case that the time has come for this project as well, and ask DOT and the legislature to move this one up to the top of the queue if that can be done. The other projects, as you know, we partner pretty closely with Port of Skagit on the Swift Center development there. We've been working extensively with them on trail improvements down there. They're participating in the funding for the Olmsted Park improvements to $400,000, and hopefully we'll increase that a bit. And so I asked them to provide me with their legislative priorities, and I will do the same for them. And we've mutually agreed that we'll raise those with the legislators when we're talking. The port has been very supportive of our corridor projects. We've largely justified or made a good pitch on justifying that on the additional traffic that the Swift Center will bring to our system. And so they recognize the importance of that corridor coming to its final fruition. So on the other side, the economic development that the Swift Center is slated to bring to the city. We want to continue to support their efforts to fund the improvements that will need to be made within the Swift Center. As you know, they've been working pretty hard on environmental cleanup, the old laundry area and the power plant, things like that. They also have some money from USED, Economic Development, for first phase improvements for the south part of the site to support the light industrial improvements that are planned there by Cedron Industries. So we will mention that, and also supporting, as I mentioned, the environmental remediation things. And Doug's already talked about the last item, and that was the AWC priorities, and I'll just kind of chime in on what he already said. We're very, very interested in seeing the TBD continue as a viable source for us. If that does go away, the other options we have that I talked to you about is looking at a 0.01 sales tax. That's what our sister agencies have morphed to, both Mount Vernon and Anacortes. And it basically doubled the revenue that they have for overlays. And certainly that would be attractive to us. There's just simply not been a good time to do that with all the other measures that have been hitting the ballots for the last 3 years. So kind of bad timing for us when the I-976 came up. Fortunately for us, that's been thrown out by the Supreme Court, but I have little doubt that that will surface again over the next year or so. So that's all of the priorities I wanted to talk about, and be glad to answer any questions you have about those things.
Okay, are there any questions for Mark? Thank you, Mark. That was a comprehensive report. Anything, Charlie, you would like to add?
Yeah, I would simply add that we anticipate bringing this back for action next meeting. So this is your opportunity if you want to see changes in it or anything to let us know. We're needing to get it done by the end of the year, if possible, because the legislative session starts pretty quickly in January. And we want to meet with legislators and get them up to speed on what we're asking for.
Sounds like you're a go with everything that was presented tonight. As far as the legislation, AWC, what we're going to put out for requests as far as transportation and capital requests with the legislature.
Are the positions coming up next Wednesday?
No, that'll be a 2022 conversation. So you won't. Yeah, we don't. We need to take our time on all of that. So
if there's nothing else, we will meet again here in a week, 6 p.m. It will be an in-person, hybrid, in-person session. And if there is nothing else, yes.
I'll be on work travel that week. Can I be Zoom?
Yes, absolutely. It'll be a hybrid, so absolutely.
I have the same issue where I'll be over in Seattle.
Okay.
I'm just going to Zoom.
No, and we would love it if you would zoom in, and hopefully you'll have your iPad by then.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, we'll have to make sure. When do you take off, on Monday?
Take off Monday morning.
Okay. Monday, so okay. Oh, wow, so that needs to be done ASAP. Okay. And Bill's online, so I'm sure he's hearing that. So what we're waiting for is actually for Mr. Lloyd to turn his iPad back in, so that can be wiped, and we can set that up for you then.
And I got that today.
Okay, good. Yeah, okay, good. Good. Okay. There's nothing else then? Y'all have a great weekend, and we'll see you Wednesday.